Welcome to Trial Lawyer Talk. I'm Scott Glovsky, and I'm your host for this podcast where we speak with some of the best trial lawyers in the country. Today, we're very lucky to have with us Greg Reeves, who's an amazing trial lawyer. Greg practices in Alabama, but he does cases all over the country. Greg's going to share with us the story of his defense of a capital murder case, and some other highlights from the interview include what we can learn as trial lawyers from comedians, the benefits of focus groups, and how we can make the world a better place. So let's get started. This is Scott Glovsky, and we're here on Trial Lawyer Talk, and I'm very happy today to be sitting with my good friend, Greg Reeves. Greg is a phenomenal trial lawyer who does all kinds of personal injury cases, but also has a particular emphasis in sex abuse cases. Greg is from Alabama, but he tries cases all over the country. I had the distinct pleasure of trying a case with him a couple months ago, and Greg is one of the most authentic, real, humble, and funny guys I know. Greg, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Scott. I'm glad to be here.
Greg, can you share with us a story of a case that had a profound impact on you?
I can, and I will say this, Scott, because I know from our work together involves mostly dealing with, say, child sex abuse, but I would probably cast myself more as generic trial lawyer. I've tried criminal cases, back in the day, divorce cases, but now my focus is on personal injury. So that's I know that's a broad umbrella, and I also realize that, a lot of lawyers have niches, but there's a part of me nowadays that thinks if you go to the courtroom and try a case, civil or criminal, that's almost a niche in and of itself. But, we're here in Wyoming, at the Trial Lawyers College, and that I can't help but think how I got here. So I'd like to tell you the story of that, and that takes us back to 1993. And I had been out of law school for a couple of years, had a judge who back then, not a judge, but all the judges appointed lawyers to represent people who could not afford a lawyer. We've all heard that. If you can't afford a lawyer, one will be appointed. Well, I was the one often. And was appointed to represent a fellow by the name of Nathaniel Morris on a capital murder charge. And worked on that case for 3 years. And it was instrumental because it was really not what I had started out wanting to do. I thought in law school, my father's a real estate broker, my family was in home building, and I thought when I came out of law school that I'd be closing real estate loans. So here I am with a client who's charged with not only murder, but capital murder. And I'll tell you, even then, I'm very competitive, and the sense was, how am I going to help this person? So this was pre-internet. And what I mean by that is that there weren't all these books and videos and guides on how to do things. So I felt like, and it felt really like, in a way, climbing Mount Everest or something. And that may have been for anybody, but it did especially for me being new out of law school. And having not handled many criminal cases, I'll tell you just briefly, the same time the O.J. Simpson trial was going on, so I'd read and hear in the news, routinely about he had a dream team and all the great lawyers he had. And I knew he was a famous movie star and a famous athlete, college and pro, and well-regarded. And there was just this huge contrast with the case that I had. I had a client who had been previously convicted of murder, had served time for murder, You know, when my guy was introduced to our jury, it was that he was a former felon, convicted murderer. So there's no question about that. And he certainly wasn't famous and didn't have any money, or he would have hired somebody else besides me. So, tried that case. My co-counsel at the time was really just fed up with practicing law and actually left law to go work at Lowe's, like in the garden department. And it gave me an opportunity to select my next co-counsel. I asked somebody to help me try it, and they said they would. They were an older lawyer. And, you know, just briefly, the thing that they kept letting me know was that my ideas were somewhat novel or unique. I think the word he used was malpractice. But, and just to give you a couple examples, my friend said, well, one of us is going to have to death qualify the jury. And I said, well, what does that mean? And he said, well, we need to find out how they feel about the death penalty. And I said, look, we grew up here. I did, you did. If you can find five people in this whole county who are against the death penalty, I'll give you $100. I'm not doing it. We're not doing that, because it really sends a message. And the message that it sends, and this is just out of my gut, was at the very beginning of the trial, if I'm talking to them about the death penalty, it presumes that my client's guilty, not innocent. And if I'm his lawyer, I'm his advocate. So if I'm presuming that, what are they to think? So we didn't do that. He may have said, Greg, we've got to ask something about it. And I said, well, I'm not. You can ask a question or two, but I think that's not the right way to go. And he said, well, that's malpractice. But he would say, but we'll go that way. We'll do that. We'll try that. The other thing was our client wanted to testify strongly. And I remember saying, our client has managed in the span of 20 years to be arrested for murder twice. Not much else that he could put on his resume. You and I went to law school and, you know, did okay and passed the bar. And I don't really know that he's the right person that should be calling the shots like that. And I probably said it a lot stronger than that. But my point was, he's not going to testify. And he didn't. And he didn't over his objection. In other words, the client strongly wanted to. And every time he... Now, look, you know, hindsight's always 20/20, and the rest of that story is that we had a client who was charged with capital murder. His roommate was found dead. He was arrested 2 weeks later. They were roommates. My guy had cleaned out his bedroom totally. Arrested 2 weeks later in a hotel room under an alias, had nothing but a six-pack of beer and blood on his pants. The neighbors said that my guy had threatened to kill his roommate. They brought in a jail cellmate at trial that said he had roomed with my client awaiting trial. My client waited trial 3 years, and that my client had admitted to the murder. My client was supposed to report into probation officer every month being on parole for murder, and he didn't do that. So they brought in the probation officer to talk about his failure to report. And with that said, we walked away with an acquittal. We spared his life, but in a straight up not guilty. I was 5 years out of law school, and I knew then, you know, just from my conversations with my co-counsel, that I did things differently.
But how did you get him off?
You know, I'll say, I don't know that there's, I think any lawyer that has victories can't point, we'd love to point to one thing. We'd love to say, oh, I did this, I did that. And I'll say this, I've come to realize there's as much as luck as anything. I do think strategy is important. I think strategy is huge. And if I think that I have something to bring to the table on a case, it is strategy. I focus grouped that case, and you know, we hear a lot about focus grouping now, but that was a time where I didn't know anybody else that did it. I only knew that I wanted to know what normal non-lawyers thought about these facts. I really didn't care what my lawyer friends had to say. And the way that brought me to TLC, Trial Lawyers College, was I remember reading about this lawyer named Jerry Spence. And I'd say growing up or in my neck of the woods, I wouldn't say he was real famous or well-known. At least I'd never heard of him. But he had some videotapes. They were VHS tapes. And I think it was through the American, what was known as American Trial Lawyer Association, where he said, how to win in voir dire, how to win an opening. And I ordered those VHS tapes, and I sat there and watched them. I think I watched the voir dire ones all the way through a couple times, opening statement. And the thing that this guy emphasized more than anyone else that I knew was, tell your story. Tell the story. And so the story for this case, or the theme, was they made an arrest and then tried to make a conviction. Now, I never said that during the trial. You know, like any good theme, it's not something I would stand there and say, but yet I tried to make that the backbone of the case. And our point was, yes, it looks bad, but there's nothing tying this fella in to this murder. And the most damning evidence, probably, if there was any, was the fact that he had blood on his pants. This was 1996, and I cannot explain why, but for whatever reason, the forensics said that the DNA failed to amplify. And so, you know, there was, you know, certainly for him, there were certainly lucky breaks. But I'll say that I had a mindset that we would win. I've learned a lot. And Scott, I'm not saying this is a model for those lawyers who do those cases, and I probably will never do another one. I'm safe with my 1-0 capital murder record. I know they worry about and are concerned, rightly so, about mitigation and all those. I can tell you that in working on that case for 3 years, every day, I thought about the case. I tried to do things on it, work on it. The total time I spent on mitigation was less than 1 minute. In fact, I told my co-counsel, if we get a conviction, I'm so laser focused on winning. It was every part of me was that if we lose, you will take over. You will have to do every bit of it. I'll sit there, but I will not be. It just felt incongruent for me to prepare a case to win it, and then prepare all this of, oh, in case we lose. Now, that's me, and that's probably a shortcoming of mine. I guess if I maybe was a better lawyer, I could juggle both. But, and again, I'll just say, at that time, I had tried a grand total of 4 jury trials. And there weren't seminars, there weren't, other than those videotapes, there just wasn't a whole lot out there on trial strategy or trial advocacy that I knew of. But when we got that not guilty, I said, I need to go meet Jerry Spence. And so I applied for the college and came out here in 1998. So
tell us your story, Greg. Where do you get the power, the insecurity, the connection to your client?
In that case or in any case?
In any case.
You know, I think, for example, in that case, my thought was, well, I'd say in any case, I think, what is it that I want to hang my hat on? Like, what is it that if I had to say, well, this gives me some pause, you know? And part of that, I think it's important to be congruent. It's important to be authentic. And so, you know, in every case I have, I try to find something that speaks to me about this person, about who they are, or about what happened. And, you know, we'll spend time discovering the story. And this is stuff, you know, you and I talk about and other trial lawyers talk about. But I'll say back then, for me, it was just a matter of trying to figure out what speaks to me about this case, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. Can you talk about the power of listening?
Yeah, I can. And we are trained to be speakers. You know, that's what, you know, we all probably had a class in college speaking. A lot of books out on how to give a talk, how to give a TED talk, how to do this, you know. And there's really very, very few, even if there were books or videos on listening, I don't know that they would effectively convey it. And probably one of the most well-read books, at least in America, is The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And there's one of those 7 habits that says, seek first to understand and then to be understood. I remember hearing that. I remember reading it. And I remember thinking, I don't get it. Like, what does that mean? I mean, on one level, I got it, but I actually would buy Stephen Covey tapes and hear him talk about it, expand about it. And he talked about getting beyond the words to trying to figure out how the person actually felt, you know, and then putting that out there. Like, you look like this is, you know, it sounds like this is bothering you, or it sounds like this is troubling you. And I remember thinking, wow, that's a whole nother way of relating to people. And you know, if I think back about the people who've been instrumental in my life in that realm, it would be, you know, teachers and college professor in particular, that just had a real knack for understanding. And I wanted to be able to do that. And I'll say this, I know for years, I'd say I was a terrible listener. And I, you know, really envied those people who were really good at it. And I knew when I was around people who are good at it, but I just really didn't understand how they did it. And I'll say that I think it's something that can be developed, something that can be enhanced.
How have you developed your ability to listen?
You know, it's just one of those things that we all get to practice every day. You know, as lawyers, we tend to think, well, by golly, I'm going to really listen to this client, or I'm going to, and at the same time, maybe we ignore our receptionist or our colleague, our spouse, our children. And so, you know, at some point, and of course, I read a lot and go to workshops and so forth, but it just seemed to me that the better I communicate depends on how well I can listen, you know, how well I can understand what my client's saying, what the judge is saying, what the other side is saying. And we've all known that person that maybe took everything very literal or didn't seem to understand when someone was going through pain or even what to say or maybe to be quiet. So I'd like to think I've advanced in that. I don't know. You might have to ask my wife that or my children.
Tell me about the concept of story and its relevance to the trial.
You know, coming through law school, we're graded on showing our professors how much we know. You're given a question and you write pages about it. Same with a bar exam. And then it's almost like a learned behavior that wow, we're going to write 5 different pages on this one topic. And so we're learned with the law school admission test, we talk about logic. So nowhere in there do you hear the word story. And so it's easy to think of, it's easy to come from that training and that education. And also, I'd say a lot of lawyers are analytical. They're very bright. So they come to view what happened, we'll call them the facts, is maybe something you just put in a shaker and shake up and roll out on the table. I mean, these are the facts. But story looks more at how do we connect these facts such that they make sense. You know, as human beings, we're constantly trying to make sense of things. You know, we could watch clouds move and try to make a story out of it, or an animal play, or we could say, oh, well, this is what the bird was thinking when they did that, or this. And so we, you know, our survival, our brains have, you know, are geared such to make meaning out of facts. You know, even today you'll hear about some weather event and some politician will say something crazy about, oh, well, this means that God must be mad or something. But what I'd point out is we try to make meaning out of events. It helps give us a sense of maybe purpose. It helps give us things to work for. It just helps us make sense of life when we know those. So, you know, we're hardwired for story. And I'll tell you, there's a difference. If you ever go to a lecture or you go in a courtroom, the difference is between someone talking in terms of information, like, you know, hey, this is the, you know, 3,000 people this, 3 million people this, 100 homes this, versus somebody telling a story. I mean, it's almost like once the story starts, the room really gets quiet. And we tune in and plug in. And, you know, I think those stories are how a lot of us learn to live our lives. Not in a bad way, but that's, you know, you got to remember, we existed a long time as humans before television, internet, movies. And it was story. Fables, myths that taught us, hey, this is the way you do things. This is the way you handle situations. This is how to live in the world. And so I know that being hardwired for story, it's easy to maybe put that on a back burner as an attorney. I'll just say this. I'm interested in good communicators. Who's doing good work? So if you think about it in that terms, you know, there could be an elite viewpoint or an academic viewpoint of, oh, wow, this person's very educated and they're such a great communicator. And I tend to look at it more on a level of who are people taking their hard-earned money to pay to go here? You know, not the academics, but who's the everyday people paying money to go here? Who can take a huge stadium and for an hour and a half keep their attention without a PowerPoint? No slides, no fancy animations or gadgets. It's them and a microphone and a stage and a light and a group. And it's comedians. And I don't mean to say that as lawyers, we need to turn into Rodney Dangerfield or we need to stand up there and tell jokes. But I'll say this. If you look at some of the best comedians of our time, they take viewpoints. They take a fresh look at it. And they're very honest. It's very congruent with who they are. And they talk for an hour, hour and a half. And you've got, George Carlin, Chris Rock, Jim Gaffigan, Dave Chappelle. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And they're there on a stage, and the only thing between them and the audience is a microphone. And they're able to talk, often Jerry Seinfeld, about everyday subjects, but it's a new perspective. And it's honest, and it's real, and sometimes it's vulnerable. And there's a connection there. And I just say, I've spent time thinking about that. I think that's probably actually scarier than trying to get, you know, maybe a murder case or a capital murder case. To me, it would be pretty frightening. And I just think that for what we do as lawyers, we could learn a lot from what they do in communication. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. How do you continue to grow as a person while being a trial lawyer trying cases around the country?
Well, you know, I did get to try a case in California earlier this year, and I haven't tried. That was my first venture out of Alabama, and I'll say this: I've been told that I have a real thick Southern accent. I don't know if that's true or not, but
I haven't noticed.
Hadn't noticed that, but I found that once you're in the courtroom, you know, the judge does his or her thing, which is being the judge. The defense lawyer does their thing, which is pointing out all the things wrong with our case, or, you know, with the case. And then the jury does their thing, and people are, you know, there's real universal truths there. So, you may have places, even within Alabama, that are, would say, more conservative or more liberal. But there's also, you know, I think our task a lot of time is to try to tap into what's the universal truth. You know, what happened and what's the universal truth. So did your question ask about personal growth, though?
Yeah, well, I want to ask you now how you find the universal truth in your case.
I think we all, I give this as an example. If we went to a horse track and bet on a horse, you know, 10 minutes ago, they were all horses. After somebody puts a bet on it, all of a sudden they want Lightning to win. You know, Lightning's my horse, and it's the best horse, and look at it. Can't you tell it's going to win? I mean, that all of a sudden, this one horse out of a dozen or whatever is just, it's just so special horse, you know. And the difference, what changed? Well, we put money on it. And I think as lawyers, we get our cases in, and all of a sudden when they're our clients, our cases, our situations, naturally, we want to help these people, and it can affect our judgment. It can affect we may start to see them differently than, say, a jury would, because a jury is a group that hadn't bet on a horse. They don't, to use another expression, they don't have a dog in that fight. So I think our task is to listen to our clients, to learn their stories. And at the same time, what I have found over and over and over again for 25 years is value in taking these situations to people who don't have a dog in the fight and saying, hey, you know, the phrase that we hear a lot is focus group. But to go to these people and say, hey, look, and whether I do it, well, I do my own, and I've been told that's not a good thing, but it's what I do, and I've done it for years, and so far it seems to work. And I've done them for other people too, but basically to say, hey, what do you think about this situation? What's your thoughts about this? And really get input from other people, because I think it helps us see these situations better. And, you know, face it, in our work, if you have a jury trial, it's going to be a group of people drawn from the community. So why would I ask some of my lawyer friends what they think about this case? I mean, sure, I may ask them about legal nuances or questions involving evidence or so forth, but when it gets down to that, and you say, well, wouldn't you know that? I think, but at the same time, I think there's value in finding out opinions and viewpoints from people who don't maybe know the situation quite as well, that just give me, that don't have any stake in it, so to speak. And so that's a way to learn universal truths. Another way would be reenactment, you know, to go back and to reenact whatever happened, and maybe to step back and look at it. I mean, that could be helpful. So those would be some good tools to find universal truths.
Greg, I've had the pleasure of watching you in the courtroom and watching you stay so calm and collected in the midst of incredible stress and serious battle. Can you tell me how you do that, and also about the incongruence with the stress and anxiety contrasted with how you stay so collected and calm?
Well, and I'll say this, Guy, what you see on the outside may not always tell the tale of what's going on in the inside. So I feel that I have probably so much anxiety and so much stress that the only thing I can analogize it to is there was a phase in my life. I read a lot of books, and there was a phase in my life where I read a lot of books by football players. I didn't play football. And occasionally, I watch a game and I watch some, but it's not like I'm a diehard football fan. But what I found, oh gosh, I went through Bo Jackson, Reggie White, Tim Green, Dick Butkus, Vince Lombardi. You know, all these books about football, and I found this common thread, which was stress and anxiety before a game, you know, big game. And, you know, it's something they've prepared for, worked for. It just seems so similar to our work in the courtroom, you know, getting ready for a trial, that sort of thing. And of course, their work's physical and mental. You know, ours is more mental than physical. But what I would see over and over again is this thought of, you know, trying to calm nerves, trying to stay focused. But no matter how that went, once the kickoff was, a calmness would come over them. And I'll just say, in trying jury trials, I do get stressed. I do have anxiety. And there's just something once the judge blows the whistle, so to speak, and says game on and the time is running and all that, I just feel a sense of peace. And I can't explain it. And the only thing that I could say is similar to that is reading those stories of football players who would say, we practice, and once it's game time, you know, it just they seem peaceful. So maybe that's it. And I've had this thought lately about lawyer personas too, and I think with the internet, YouTube, and different things, you know, our view of different professionals may have changed. You know, we have an opportunity to know people, for better or worse, in a lot more intimate way, or closer way, or different way than we would have, say, 30 years ago. But maybe along the line of answering that question, Scott, I once had a client that told me, she said, "Greg, whether I meet you in your office, see you in the courtroom, or see you out at a restaurant or a store, you're always the same Greg." And I thought that's probably the best compliment I could get, you know, because I think the persona, and a lot of people like that, you know, whether they're lawyers or not, of being this certain way in the courtroom and different out there, I just don't get it, and it doesn't work for me. And this may stem from the fact, Scott, years ago I did divorce work. People going through a divorce, I would say, want their attorney to be like the world wrestling guys. They want them to have the big belt, flashy belt, stand up on the rings, grab the mic, yell, scream, you know, throw chairs, throw somebody out of the ring. They want that show, that dominance. What the judges wanted was, if you've ever seen high school or college wrestling, or maybe Olympic wrestling, nobody's strutting around, nobody's throwing a chair, nobody's grabbing a mic and yelling, you know. It's technical, proficient wrestling. It has to do with holds and grappling and, you know, balance and leverage and all that. And I always felt, as a lawyer, again, I never wrestled, but if I did, my technique would probably be much more like the high school or college, or, you know, that sort of thing, than the world, whatever it's called, WWE or World Federation. You know, I've just never been like a Hulk Hogan, you know, in the courtroom. So I don't know that that answered that question or not, but it's certainly something that, and even you know, we get older, our classmates that were law school classmates become judges, people we practice law with become judges, and you talk to them, and they know who's being the Saturday night, you know, wrestling lawyer, you know, type lawyer, full of themselves, full of yelling, you know, making a big show and drama, and they know the guys who know their stuff technically. And I've just always wanted to be counted in that latter part.
We all have certain sayings or advice that we tell our kids. What do you tell your kids?
Oh, gosh. I just happened to think of a Willie Nelson song, but it's not what I tell my kids. And I thought, I guess because I'm sitting in Wyoming with you looking at the mountains and all this, I just thought of the song, Mama, Don't Let Your Children Grow Up to Be Cowboys. He goes on and says, let them be doctors and lawyers and such. But I don't think that would be my advice for my children either. You know, I heard years ago, and I heard it was attributed to Gandhi, is a saying that was, be the change you want to see, or be the change you want to see in the world. I don't know that I've said that a lot to them, but I hope I've practiced that. And it's certainly something that I've taken to heart. And I say that in the sense of, I remember in law school, I had a classmate a year or two older than me who went and spent 2 years in the Peace Corps, and then he spent 2 years with Habitat for Humanity. Now, then he went in the state Senate, and it was just, you know, very low key, but giving back. And I guess I'd thought about that for enough years that I thought it's really easy to complain. You know, it's easy to complain about the president and Congress and the governor. And I remember when I was in, I think I was 17, I read a book that said, if you want to make the world a better place, maybe you start with your own backyard. And so a few years ago, with that in mind, I ran for city council. And I remember thinking, I may not change the world. I may not change the United States. I'm not going to change, you know, Alabama, but I'm going to do what I can to do something besides complaining. And I'll tell you that that was a good experience. You know, I learned what it was like to be uninformed and very opinionated, meaning, you know, right. We're all right, aren't we? And then I learned what it was like to spend hours and hours and hours and hours and days at City Hall, you know, learning, getting familiar. And I realized that things weren't quite as simple or easy as they were before I was elected. And so anyway, it was a really neat experience. And I don't mean by that to say that no one should ever criticize elected officials or all that, but I just feel that if we have these opportunities, especially as lawyers, and we're given gifts from God, intelligence and insight, and we have opportunities to use that, then there is a way at times to help the greater good more so than one client or even dozens of clients. And for me personally, that was just important. You know, it was just important for me to do that. And so, anyway, my advice to my kids on that would be what I try to do, which is to be the change that I want to see.
Greg, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us. I'm very fond of you. I'm very lucky to have you as my friend.
I feel the same way, Scott. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you for joining us today for Trial Lawyer Talk. If you like the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good review on iTunes, and I'd love to get your feedback. You can reach me at www.scottglovsky.com. That's scottglovsky.com. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You can also check out the book that I published called Fighting Health Insurance Denials, A Primer for Lawyers. That's on Amazon. I put the book together based on 20 years of suing health insurance companies for denying medical care to people, and it provides a general outline of how to fight health insurance denials. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you in the next episode.